The Tom Woods Show, episode 2287.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. I'm giving away three free courses from my Liberty Classroom. One of them is ex-Marxist Michael Rechtenwald teaching you about critical theory so you can understand leftism and fight it better, as well as our course on how Alexander Hamilton screwed up America and the history of the conservative and libertarian movements. Check it out at 3freecourses.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. Our old friend Eric Brakey is back with us again, and I know for a fact this is the first time we've talked to Eric since his victory in Maine. We used to describe Eric as a former state senator in Maine, but he is once again a state senator in Maine. So I want to talk to him about a bunch of things he's been up to and things that other people have been up to, it turns out, with regard to him. So Eric, welcome back.
Hey, Tom, it's been a little while. Thanks for having me back on. And thank you to you and Jenna both for the very kind notes you sent me when I won my very hard-fought election to get back to the state Senate. That was very kind of you both.
My pleasure. Absolutely. Our pleasure. Now, let me say, by the way, my recollection is that it was a pretty close election. Is that right?
That's right. It actually came down to a recount. This is the Senate district that I represented for two terms before I left in 2018 to run for the United States Senate. So I've been out of it for 4 years. Democrats took the seat when I left it. They've held it since, and they fought like heck to try to keep this seat. We were outspent about 5-1 in terms of outside spending. About $500,000 was spent against me in this race, which is about as much money as was spent against me in my recent congressional primary 2 years ago. So maybe $500,000 doesn't sound like a lot depending on the state that you're in. But in a small state like Maine, it's relatively unprecedented to see that much money going into a state Senate race.
So we can assume that's because you, having been in there for two terms before, they know quite well what you're all about.
Yeah, they knew that they were going to have a lot of fights to deal with if I got back in there. And well, I'm making sure that they didn't spend their money in vain. I'm giving them quite a bit of a fight every single day in Augusta.
Let's start with some interesting news we got via the so-called Twitter files. Now, this is a term we use to refer to various batches of information that's come out of Twitter that we hadn't had access to until Elon Musk took over, that has to do with various nefarious activities going on in the background. And so some portions of the Twitter files have had to do with suppressing dissident voices on COVID. Other things had to do with Russiagate. And in general, it's made clear more or less what we suspected already, but now complete with a lot of specifics about the suppression of dissident voices and an obvious bias and agenda at work in Twitter. Well, it turns out that old Eric Brakey here is actually some activity related to you that involved Angus King has come out now because of the journalistic work of Matt Taibbi. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I can. This came out very recently and I was a little surprised. You know, I was actually serving as the MC of a local Lincoln Day dinner just the other night in my home county. And as I'm there hosting the event, my phone just starts exploding and I'm wondering what's going on. And yes, these Twitter files had come out revealing that in 2018, as I mentioned, I left the state Senate to run for the United States Senate against incumbent U.S. Senator and current state senator now, Angus King. And it turns out that his campaign had put together what some are calling an enemies list of social media accounts, over 300 accounts, many folks right here in Maine, but also some folks across the country. The common denominator with a lot of these folks is that they were retweeting and sharing content from me or expressing excitement about Rand Paul's visit to Maine, rallying in support of my candidacy, or just being very critical of Angus King on social media. These accounts include many people who've been former candidates for office in the state, including a former independent candidate for governor. Austin Peterson's wife is on the list because apparently she retweeted content or shared content supporting my candidacy in 2018. It's really bizarre. And to think that this was 5 years ago and we would have never even known that this happened if it weren't for the Twitter files, I have many people, including Senator Paul's wife, Kelly Paul, have encouraged me to file ethics complaints against Angus King for this. And we're currently looking at kind of what legal options are here, because this certainly seems like how a political mob boss operates, not one of our upstanding public servants, if those even exist anymore.
How did you find out about this? Were you just on Twitter and you discovered it and your eyes popped out of your head, or did somebody call you?
I got a lot of text messages and Facebook messages and Twitter DMs from people all across the country who were reading the Twitter files and saying, wait, is that the Eric Brakey that we know? He's here in the Twitter files? And folks alerted me pretty quickly. Within hours of it coming out, I heard from many people. And yeah, it's pretty alarming to see the kind of backhanded censorship that has been going on, where government officials colluding with private companies to suppress political dissent. It certainly violates the spirit of the First Amendment, if not the outright text of it.
Well, I bet this was not something you expected to happen, and it was not something you and I were expecting to talk about. We're going to talk about the things you're up to in Maine as maybe a case study in what other legislators, if they are so motivated, might be able to try in their own states. So let's actually shift gears to that and talk a little bit about that. Given that you squeaked your way back into that seat, and then now I'm looking at the kind of legislative agenda you want to push, you don't seem like somebody who gets elected and thinks, well, I better build up my base of support before I do anything out of the ordinary. You are just diving right in head first.
You know, I know how hard I worked to get into the seat. I didn't want to get there and just keep the seat warm. You know, that's never been how I function. I guess it is a nice segue from the U.S. Senate race and, of course, the congressional race that I ran. I ran for federal office twice, thinking maybe if I can get in there, we can help fix the system in Washington, D.C. from the inside. Maybe, Tom, maybe you chuckle when I say that, because it does sound hopelessly naive when I look back on that. I've seen firsthand just how far the political establishment has been willing to go in two campaigns. And we're, of course, with the Twitter files, we're learning even more how far they've been willing to go to keep me out of Washington, D.C. But you know what? I have realized more and more that let them have their city. They can have this city in Washington, D.C. if we can win the states. Because as you know, Tom, constitutionally, the states are much more powerful than Washington, D.C. if only they would exercise their constitutional powers and be willing to nullify the unconstitutional efforts coming out of our nation's capital. And what encourages me is not just that I won this state Senate seat in Maine and that we have more Ron Paul-influenced liberty legislators in Maine than certainly many more than when I was there last, but that this is a phenomenon that's happening across the country of Ron Paul-inspired liberty legislators getting elected to their state capitals. And so we are seeing a wave of nullification efforts across the country, and I'm doing my part in Maine with some bills that people may be familiar with and some that are a little more original. I'm sponsoring legislation for the Second Amendment Protection Act, saying that our state, county, and municipal officials will not enforce federal gun control laws within our state borders. If the people of Maine want gun control, that should be passed by our legislature or a referendum or through our processes for setting our laws, not by the ATF doing an end round around our processes and trying to dictate from the top down that people can't own certain kinds of firearms or that we're going to have red flag laws where people are going to be targeted for gun confiscation based on arbitrary criteria with no due process. I'm also sponsoring the Fourth Amendment Preservation Act, which is a very similar principle, saying our officials are not going to cooperate with the federal government in any investigations that they are doing that are built upon information they got illegally without a warrant from a judge, which, of course, is very common in this digital age of surveillance. One I'm very excited about that I'm sure your audience is familiar with, though, is the Defend the Guard bill, which I am sponsoring and championing and working with the folks from Bring Our Troops Home. I will tell you, I'm very excited that the committee that's going to hear this legislation has four Ron Paul Republicans on the committee, which in the past, when we've been trying to fight for Defend the Guard legislation, it was like challenging to get a single vote in committee. But now, because we have Ron Paul supporters running for the state legislature, we're in an actual strong position to make a strong case for calling our National Guardsmen home from wars that have not been declared by Congress and trying to restore those proper checks and balances to war making.
Okay, actually, let me jump in right there, just because not everybody necessarily knows about the Defend the Guard legislation. I mean, you and I live and breathe this stuff all the time, but that basically is what it's about. It's an attempt on the part of the states to exert some kind of power over where people wind up getting deployed, and or rather the circumstances, if they're being sent without congressional authority.
Absolutely. You know, the Constitution's pretty clear. The National Guard is different from all the other branches of our military, the federal branches of our military. The National Guard in each state answers to the governor. The governor is the commander in chief of the state National Guard. And the Constitution says the National Guard can be called up by the federal government for combat under three circumstances: to suppress insurrection or to repel invasion. Both of those, of course, are domestic, right? Within our borders, we're repelling an invasion or suppressing insurrection. Neither of those criteria would apply to, say, the war in Syria. But then the third one is to enforce the laws of the Union. So what does that mean? Well, it means if Congress declares war and our representatives sign their names to a declaration of war against a foreign adversary, then the federal government has the authority to call forth the National Guard and send them abroad to fight overseas. But of course, in the war on terror of the last two decades, most of my lifetime, there's never been a declaration of war in any of these. Many of these war zones, there's never been even been an AUMF. And our National Guardsmen account for about 50% of the troops that have been on the ground in these combat zones, in these wars for the last two decades. And the hard thing is, Congress knows that it would be unpopular at home among their constituents to vote for these wars. So they don't want to vote for the wars, but they also don't want to vote against the wars because that would be unpopular with their donors in the military-industrial complex. And so for those of us who have been calling for decades for the federal government to do something to end the wars, there's no incentive for them to do so. There's this diffusion of accountability that they'll just let the executive branch and the unelected bureaucracy of our government that nobody voted for, we'll let them decide where and when we go to war. And that way, Congress can send a sharply worded letter saying, we don't like that you're doing this or that, but they never actually do anything about it. This is why the states have to stand up and demand accountability.
Well, this is, to the ears of some people, a rather radical program. Now, to us, we think, well, this is just our opening salvo. But to some people, and not even necessarily because of the specifics involved, but because people have grown so accustomed to the states as being just administrative units to be more or less dictated to by the central government. And the idea that they could push back or refuse to comply, it's not familiar to most people. They've not heard of this. So for you to kind of all of a sudden run in there and start attempting to implement measures like this could take a lot of people by surprise. And I would guess you're going to get a lot of pushback.
Well, absolutely. And I think there's a path to some of these passing in the Maine legislature this year, but certainly it's going to be an uphill climb with Democrats in charge right now. But even if Republicans had been in charge, it would have been an uphill climb. We're kind of forcing a conversation on some of these things. But of course, as you know, Tom, because you literally wrote the book on nullification, this tradition of nullification is very much grounded in the construction of our constitutional compact. You look back to the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions drafted by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison in response to the Sedition Acts, basically violating First Amendment free speech rights of the people under the Adams administration. It was very clear they believed that the states, as the creators of the federal government, as the parties to the constitutional contract, had a responsibility to enforce that contract. And when the federal government overstepped the bounds of the limited enumerated powers granted to it, that it was the responsibility of the states to nullify those unconstitutional usurpations of power. And that's exactly what I'm proposing. And of course, some of the things we've talked about so far are just the beginning. You know, I have legislation and we've been dealing with our lobster industry, and this has garnered some national attention in recent years. Maybe some people know about it, but we've been dealing with incredibly unjustifiable regulations from the federal government targeting our lobster industry, driving our lobstermen out of business, which is a major industry for Maine, not just in terms of economically, but also just in terms of our whole identity of what it means to be a Mainer is so wrapped up in Maine lobster. And our Maine lobster industry is being destroyed by federal regulators coming in with completely unscientific and unreasonable regulations. And so I have legislation in that would say, you know what? This wouldn't be a problem if we had sovereignty over our oceans, right? We only have recognized sovereignty over our ocean waters up to 3 miles off our coastlines. Texas and Florida have 9 miles. And you go back in history, at one point in Maine, it was 12 miles. So working with some other Ron Paul legislators, we decided, hey, we're just going to put in a bill and declare that we're going to have a sovereignty over 12 miles out from our coastline. And what is the federal government going to do about it? These have historically been our waters. Let's kick the federal regulators out of here. But I'm also very excited about, I think, even two more novel nullification bills that I'm putting in that are, I guess, a little bit more original, though one of them is directly inspired by something I read in your book, Nullification, Tom. It's the idea of tax nullification. Looking at the federal government and how it extracts wealth from us, it does it in three ways. They tax us, they put future generations into debt, and they inflate the currency and steal the value of our savings and our retirements. And so I've been trying to think, what can we do from a state level to tackle all three aspects of how the federal government exploits us financially? On the debt side, people have proposed balanced budget amendments to the U.S. Constitution. I support that. I think that's one thing the states could do. But on the tax side, I've got a bill in that would, for tax nullification, this is what it would do. It would create a mechanism where the state of Maine, and I would love to see other states put in similar legislation, but the state of Maine would assert all of those assessed federal tax dollars that are being levied on the people of Maine. We're going to declare that instead of the people of Maine paying those federal taxes directly to the IRS, we're going to have Maine Revenue Services collect those taxes, and we're going to sit on them. We're going to have the opportunity to sit on those funds if the legislature decides to challenge portions of the federal budget on the grounds that it is for purposes that are not authorized by the Constitution. And if through our own process in our own state, we find that the states never authorized this, then we would withhold that percentage of assessed federal taxes and refund it to the people and send the rest on to Washington, D.C. Of course, how might Washington, D.C. retaliate? They might say, well, you can't do that. We're going to threaten your federal highway funds. We're going to take this or that from you, because, of course, that's how the federal government controls us. They take our money and ransom it back to us with strings attached so the states will dance to their unconstitutional tunes. But, of course, in this case, if they threatened our federal highway funds, we could just say, well, that's fine. We won't send that money to you in the first place, and we'll use it to supplant the money that you would have sent us. Because, of course, all that money they're giving back to us was taken from us in the first place. So maybe that's a bit of a radical idea. I don't know if anything like that has ever been introduced in a state legislature before, but I'm trying to think creatively about how we can tackle this hydra that is the federal government.
Well, at the very least, it seems to me that people who come along and introduce radical ideas on the other side don't say to themselves, I better not do this, you know? I don't know if everybody's ready. They just do it. Whereas our side hems and haws and, well, we don't want to alienate people. But if for some reason, it seems like the side that does not care about alienating people is somehow running our society. So maybe we ought to do what they do sometimes.
Yeah, we got to shift the Overton window in our direction. We can't just be we can't just be progressives driving the speed limit, right? We're standing firm on whatever the radical left demanded 20 years ago. We've got to be moving the ball in the direction of state sovereignty and restoring liberty. And one last idea, Tom, and this is actually something I've been consulting a little bit with on to develop with our mutual friend, Tho Bishop, which is, it's been a question in my mind, what can states do to nullify the power of the Federal Reserve? Because of course, especially right now with inflation being what it is, people are thinking about it more than ever. And in Maine, not only are we experiencing the problem of inflation, but we're also experiencing a problem in Maine where our biggest agricultural industry now is cannabis. We nullified federal cannabis laws on both medical and adult use cannabis. And now our cannabis industry is one of the biggest industries in our state, but it's virtually a completely unbanked industry because of federal laws. You have these businesses, they might be sitting on $100,000 of cash. They can't go to a bank and open a bank account because the federal government threatens if banks and credit unions take their money, they might come in and just seize everything. So I'm also putting in a bill that would charter a state bank that would allow all businesses operating legally within our own laws to deposit funds there. It would be a 100% reserve system, so not a fractional reserve system, which eliminates the need for federal deposit insurance, which is one of the things that the federal government uses to yank these banks around to get them to work with the cannabis industry. But also this bank would coin its own gold currency that would be available to help people get access to assets that could protect their wealth from Federal Reserve-induced inflation. And also that gold currency could be available with 100% reserves. The bank could issue crypto tokens on the blockchain that are redeemable with 100% reserves for physical gold at the bank. I know some people might bristle at the idea of, oh, you're creating a new kind of state institution. That's not very libertarian. But I would say we need to be willing to use state power to combat federal power. We don't want to use state power to combat the rights and the freedoms of the people, but we do want to use state power to defend the freedoms and the rights of the people from an overreaching federal government. And that's what every proposal I'm bringing forward looks to do.
Wasn't it funny when, Andrew Cuomo, maybe one or two other governors, maybe Gavin Newsom, suddenly discovered the 10th Amendment when it was, we want to be able to have the power to keep our society shut down. And the federal government has never been delegated the power to open our societies. I mean, of all things to assert the 10th Amendment for, but apparently they remember that it's in there, but they wanted to use it for the worst possible purposes. What kind of advice do you have for other state legislators?
I would say be bold. What do we have to lose at this point? The federal government gets further and further out of line with constitutional principles every new administration that goes by. And we can fight back. We can bring balance to the force, but it requires getting involved through the state legislature and exercising our constitutional authority. So I'm so encouraged when I see states that have passed many of these proposals, like Missouri has passed the Second Amendment Preservation Act. Arizona, I believe it was their Senate Armed Services Committee, just passed Defend the Guard. This is the first state where Defend the Guard legislation has gotten so far even passed out of committee with majority support. I think that oftentimes, particularly small states, small population states like Maine and New Hampshire and maybe Wyoming, a lot of these small states, we often think to ourselves, well, how can we stand up against the federal government? We're so small and they're so big. And if we step out of line, we know they're going to retaliate. We know they're going to threaten our federal funding for this or that. We know that. But you know what? If small states like Maine and Idaho and New Hampshire and Wyoming, if we all stood together and we all started sponsoring nullification bills and passing them into law together, suddenly those small states don't look so small. It's easy to push one of us around, but it's not so easy to push all of us around. So that's why I'm so encouraged that we have so many liberty legislators through, for example, the Young Americans for Liberty Hazlitt Coalition that have been elected, hundreds of Ron Paul-influenced liberty legislators now in state capitals across the country, where when I was in the Senate from 2014 to 2018, you could count us all on probably two hands. You could count all of us. So something has really been happening in recent years with so many folks inspired to run and win and stand up for people's freedoms and liberties. And so I put forward this blueprint. I encourage any state legislators across the country who may be listening or activists who know state legislators who are bold enough to stand up to the federal government. If you like any of these ideas, steal them, run with them. You don't even have to credit me. I just want to see more states standing up to Washington, D.C.
What is your online presence like? You're on Twitter. So I'll link to that. In fact, what is your Twitter handle?
It's an easy one to remember. It's at Senator Brakey.
Okay, Senator, and then that's B-R-A-K-E-Y. And then anything else, anywhere else I can direct people to after this conversation?
Yeah, certainly. You can find me on Twitter. You can find me on Facebook, Eric Brakey for Maine Senate. I do a lot more kind of communicating more with local Maine people on Maine issues there. Twitter, I use a lot more for national conversation on national issues, but you can find me. You can find me either place. I'm also looking to restart my, I've taken a hiatus through the campaign and everything of my own podcast, which you've been on, Tom, the Free America Now podcast, but I'm talking with my old producer about getting that up and going again in the near future. So people can look out for that.
Excellent. Excellent. Okay. I am so glad to hear about all these good things happening in Maine. If they're successful, that's great. But even if they're not, you're getting people to talk about things that nobody is talking about. And you're getting them to consider approaches that they've never even thought of before. And very, very few people are doing that. So you are, in numerous ways, a genuine trailblazer. And I appreciate your efforts very much. And I'm so glad you won. I remember that night thinking, well, this didn't turn out quite as well as I'd hoped, but how's Brakey doing? How are we going to find out about Eric Brakey? And so we were checking on your Senate, like your campaign Facebook page or whatever it is that you had. We were trying to look on social media to see what was going on. And then to find out that it was a definite, ultimately, that you had indeed won. It reminded me of the old days when I would check, even though I was not very interested in politics in, say, 1996 and thereabouts, for 96, 98, 2000, even though I wasn't that interested, I would always check to see if Ron Paul had been reelected. And I didn't even know what he was up to, but I just felt better knowing he was there. And so likewise, even though I don't live in Maine, I have friends in Maine, and I'm glad you're there looking out for them. So thanks so much, Eric. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Tom. And you've been an inspiration to me over the years. So your encouragement means a great deal.
Thanks, Eric. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.